Despite all the talk in Colorado about aerospace, biotech, computer software, telecommunications, and other industries of the future, the largest private employer in the state today is the restaurant industry. In Colorado Springs, the restaurant industry has grown much faster than the population. Over the last three decades, the number of restaurants has increased fivefold. The number of chain restaurants has increased tenfold. In 1967, Colorado Springs had a total of 20 chain restaurants. Now, it has 21 McDonald's. The fast food chains feed off the sprawl of Colorado Springs, accelerate it, and help set its visual tone. They build large signs to attract motorists and look at cars the way predators view herds of prey. The chains thrive on traffic, lots of it, and put new restaurants at intersections where traffic is likely to increase, where development is heading, but real estate prices are still low. Fast food restaurants often serve as the shock troops of sprawl, landing early and pointing the way. Some chains prefer to play follow the leader. When a new McDonald's opens, other fast food restaurants soon open nearby on the assumption that it must be a good location. Regardless of the billions spent on marketing and promotion, all the ads on radio and TV, all the efforts to create brand loyalty, the major chains must live with the unsettling fact that more than 70% of fast food visits are impulsive. The decision to stop for fast food is made on the spur of the moment, without much thought. The vast majority of customers do not set out to eat at a Burger King, a Wendy's, or a McDonald's. Often they're not even planning to stop for food until they see a sign, a familiar building, a set of golden arches. Fast food, like the tabloids at a supermarket checkout, is an impulse buy. In order to succeed, fast food restaurants must be seen. The McDonald's Corporation has perfected the art of restaurant site selection. In the early days, Ray Kroc flew in a Cessna to find schools, aiming to put new restaurants nearby. McDonald's later used helicopters to assess regional growth patterns, looking for cheap land along highways and roads that would lie at the heart of future suburbs. In the 1980s, the chain became one of the world's leading purchasers of commercial satellite photography, using it to predict sprawl from outer space. The McDonald's Corporation has used Colorado Springs as a test site for restaurant technology, for software and machines designed to cut labor costs and serve fast food even faster. Steve Bagari, who owns five local McDonald's, showed me the new contraptions at his place on Constitution Avenue. It was a rounded, postmodern McDonald's on the eastern edge of the city. The drive-through lanes had automatic sensors buried in the asphalt to monitor the traffic. Robotic drink machines selected the proper cups, filled them with ice, and then filled them with soda. Dispensers powered by compressed carbon dioxide shot out uniform spurts of ketchup and mustard. Television monitors in the kitchen instantly displayed the customer's order. An advanced computer software essentially ran the kitchen, assigning tasks to various workers for maximum efficiency, predicting future orders on the basis of ongoing customer flow. Bagari was cordial, good-natured, passionate about his work, proud of the new devices. He told me the new software brought the just-in-time production philosophy of Japanese automobile plants to the fast food business, a philosophy that McDonald's has renamed Made for You. As he demonstrated one contraption after another, including a wireless handheld menu that uses radio waves to transmit orders, a group of construction workers across the street put the finishing touches on a new subdivision called Constitution Hills. The streets had patriotic names, and the cattle ranch down the road was for sale. Every Saturday, Eliza Zamot gets up at 5:15 in the morning. It's a struggle, and her head feels groggy as she steps into the shower. Her little sisters, Cookie and Sabrina, are fast asleep in their beds. By 5:30, Eliza's showered, done her hair, and put on her McDonald's uniform. She's 16, bright-eyed and olive-skinned, pretty and petite, ready for another day of work. Eliza's mother usually drives her the half mile or so to the restaurant, but sometimes Eliza walks, leaving home before the sun rises. Her family's modest townhouse sits beside a busy highway on the south side of Colorado Springs in a largely poor and working-class neighborhood. Throughout the day, sounds of the traffic fill the house, the steady whoosh of passing cars. But when Eliza heads for work, the streets are quiet. The sky is still dark, and the lights are out in the small houses and rental apartments along the road. When Eliza arrives at McDonald's, the manager unlocks the door and lets her in. Sometimes the husband and wife cleaning crew are just finishing up. More often, it's just Eliza and the manager in the restaurant, surrounded by an empty parking lot. For the next hour or so, the two of them get everything ready. They turn on the ovens and grills. They go downstairs into the basement and get food and supplies for the morning shift. They get the paper cups, wrappers, cardboard containers, and packets of condiments. They step into the big freezer and get the frozen bacon, the frozen pancakes, and the frozen cinnamon rolls. They get the frozen hash browns, the frozen biscuits, the frozen McMuffins. They get the cartons of scrambled egg mix and orange juice mix. They bring the food upstairs and start preparing it before any customers appear, thawing some things in the microwave and cooking other things on the grill. They put the cooked food in special cabinets to keep it warm. The restaurant opens for business at 7 o'clock, and for the next hour or so, Eliza and the manager hold down the fort, handling all the orders. As the place starts to get busy, other employees arrive. Eliza works behind the counter. She takes orders and hands food to customers from breakfast through lunch. When she finally walks home, after 7 hours of standing at a cash register, her feet hurt. She's wiped out. She comes through the front door, flops onto the living room couch, and turns on the TV. And the next morning she gets up at 5:15 again and starts the same routine. Up and down Academy Boulevard, along South Nevada, Circle Drive, and Woodman Road, teenagers like Eliza run the fast food restaurants around Colorado Springs. Fast food kitchens often seem like a scene from Bugsy Malone, a film in which all the actors are children pretending to be adults. No other industry in the United States has a workforce so dominated by adolescents. About two-thirds of the nation's fast food workers are under the age of 20. Teenagers open the fast food outlets in the morning, close them at night, and keep them going at all hours in between. Even the managers and assistant managers are sometimes in their late teens. Unlike Olympic gymnastics, an activity in which teenagers consistently perform at a higher level than adults, there's nothing about the work in a fast food kitchen that requires young employees. Instead of relying upon a small, stable, well-paid, and well-trained workforce, the fast food industry seeks out part-time, unskilled workers who are willing to accept low pay. Teenagers have been the perfect candidates for these jobs, not only because they are less expensive to hire than adults, but also because their youthful inexperience makes them easier to control. The labor practices of the fast food industry have their origins in the assembly line systems adopted by American manufacturers in the early 20th century. Business historian Alfred D. Chandler has argued that a high rate of throughput was the most important aspect of these mass production systems. A factory's throughput is the speed and volume of its flow, a much more crucial measurement, according to Chandler, than the number of workers it employs or the value of its machinery. With innovative technology and the proper organization, a small number of workers can produce an enormous amount of goods cheaply. Throughput is all about increasing the speed of assembly, about doing things faster in order to make more. Although the McDonald brothers had never encountered the term throughput or studied scientific management, they instinctively grasped the underlying principles and applied them in the speedy service system. The restaurant operating scheme they developed has been widely adopted and refined over the past half century. The ethos of the assembly line remains at its core. The fast food industry's obsession with throughput has altered the way millions of Americans work, turned commercial kitchens into small factories, and changed familiar foods into commodities that are manufactured. At Burger King restaurants, frozen hamburger patties are placed on a conveyor belt and emerge from a broiler 90 seconds later fully cooked. The ovens at Pizza Hut and at Domino's also use conveyor belts to ensure standardized cooking times. The ovens at McDonald's look like commercial laundry presses, with big steel hoods that swing down and grill hamburgers on both sides at once. The burgers, chicken, French fries, and buns are all frozen when they arrive at a McDonald's. The shakes and sodas begin as syrup. At Taco Bell restaurants, the food is assembled, not prepared. The guacamole isn't made by workers in the kitchen. It's made at a factory in Michoacán, Mexico, then frozen and shipped north. The chain's taco meat arrives frozen and pre-cooked in vacuum-sealed plastic bags. The beans are dehydrated and look like brownish cornflakes. The cooking process is fairly simple. Everything's add water, a Taco Bell employee told me. Just add hot water. Although Richard and Mac McDonald introduced the division of labor to the restaurant business, it was a McDonald's executive named Fred Turner who created a production system of unusual thoroughness and attention to detail. In 1958, Turner put together an operations and training manual for the company that was 75 pages long, specifying how almost everything should be done. Hamburgers were always to be placed on the grill in six neat rows. French fries had to be exactly 0.28 inches thick. The McDonald's operations manual today has 10 times the number of pages and weighs about 4 pounds. Known within the company as the Bible, it contains precise instructions on how various appliances should be used, how each item on the menu should look, and how employees should greet customers. Operators who disobey these rules can lose their franchises. Cooking instructions are not only printed in the manual, they are often designed into the machines. A McDonald's kitchen is full of buzzers and flashing lights that tell employees what to do. The strict regimentation at fast food restaurants creates standardized products. It increases the throughput, and it gives fast food companies an enormous amount of power over their employees. The management no longer depends upon the talents or skills of its workers. Those things are built into the operating system and machines. Jobs that have been de-skilled can be filled cheaply. The need to retain any individual worker is greatly reduced by the ease with which he or she can be replaced. Teenagers have long provided the fast food industry with the bulk of its workforce. The industry's rapid growth coincided with the baby boom expansion of that age group. Teenagers were, in many ways, the ideal candidates for these low-paying jobs. Since most teenagers still lived at home, they could afford to work for wages too low to support an adult. And until recently, their limited skills attracted few other employers. A job at a fast food restaurant became an American rite of passage, a first job soon left behind for better things. The flexible terms of employment in the fast food industry also attracted housewives who needed extra income. As the number of baby boom teenagers declined, the fast food chains began to hire other marginalized workers, recent immigrants, the elderly, and the handicapped. English is now the second language of at least one-sixth of the nation's restaurant workers, and about one-third of that group speaks no English at all. The proportion of fast food workers who cannot speak English is even higher. Many know only the names of the items on the menu. They speak McDonald's English. The fast food industry now employs some of the most disadvantaged members of American society. It often teaches basic job skills, such as getting to work on time, to people who can barely read, whose lives have been chaotic or shut off from the mainstream. Many individual franchisees are genuinely concerned about the well-being of their workers, but the stance of the fast food industry on issues involving employee training, the minimum wage, labor unions, and overtime pay strongly suggests that its motives in hiring the young, the poor, and the handicapped are hardly altruistic. At a 1999 conference on food service equipment, top American executives from Burger King, McDonald's, and Tricon Global Restaurants Incorporated, the owner of Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and KFC, appeared together on a panel to discuss labor shortages, employee training, computerization, and the latest kitchen technology. The three corporations now employ about 3.7 million people worldwide, operate about 60,000 restaurants, and open a new fast food restaurant every 2 hours. Putting aside their intense rivalry for customers, the executives had realized at a gathering the previous evening that when it came to labor issues, they were in complete agreement. "We've come to the conclusion that we're in support of each other," Dave Brewer, the vice president of engineering at KFC, explained. "We are aligned as a team to support this industry." One of the most important goals they held in common was the redesign of kitchen equipment so that less money needed to be spent training workers. "Make the equipment intuitive. Make it so that the job is easier to do right than to do wrong," advised Jerry Suss, the leading equipment systems engineer at McDonald's. "The easier it is for him, the worker, to use, the easier it is for us not to have to train him." John Reckert, Director of Strategic Operations and of Research and Development at Burger King, felt optimistic about the benefits that new technology would bring the industry. "We can develop equipment that only works one way," Reckert said. "There are many different ways today that employees can abuse our product, mess up the flow. If the equipment only allows one process, there's very little to train." Instead of giving written instructions to crew members, another panelist suggested, rely as much as possible on photographs of menu items. And if there are instructions, make them very simple. Write them at a fifth grade level and write them in Spanish and English. All of the executives agreed that zero training was the fast food industry's ideal, though it might not ever be attained. While quietly spending enormous sums on research and technology to eliminate employee training, the fast food chains have accepted hundreds of millions of dollars in government subsidies for training their workers. Through federal programs such as the Targeted Jobs Tax Credit and its successor, the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, the chains have for years claimed tax credits of up to $2,400 for each new low-income worker they hired. In 1996, an investigation by the U.S. Department of Labor concluded that 92% of these workers would have been hired by the companies anyway, and that their new jobs were part-time, provided little training, and came with no benefits. These federal subsidy programs were created to reward American companies that gave job training to the poor. Attempts to end these federal subsidies have been strenuously opposed by the National Council of Chain Restaurants and its allies in Congress. The Work Opportunity Tax Credit Program was renewed in 1996. It offered as much as $385 million in subsidies the following year. Fast food restaurants had to employ a worker for only 400 hours to receive the federal money, and then could get more money as soon as that worker quit and was replaced. American taxpayers have, in effect, subsidized the industry's high turnover rate, providing company tax breaks for workers who are employed for just a few months and receive no training. The industry front group formed to defend these government subsidies is called the Committee for Employment Opportunities. Its chief lobbyist, Bill Siner, told the Houston Chronicle that there was nothing wrong with the use of federal subsidies to create low-paying, low-skilled, short-term jobs for the poor. Trying to justify the minimal amount of training given to these workers, Siner said, "They've got to crawl before they can walk." The employees whom the fast food industry expects to crawl are by far the biggest group of low-wage workers in the United States today. The nation has about 1 million migrant farm workers and about 3.5 million fast food workers. Although picking strawberries is orders of magnitude more difficult than cooking hamburgers, both jobs are now filled by people who are generally young, unskilled, and willing to work long hours for low pay. Moreover, the turnover rates for both jobs are among the highest in the American economy. The annual turnover rate in the fast food industry is now about 300 to 400%, the typical fast food worker quits or is fired every 3 to 4 months. The fast food industry pays the minimum wage to a higher proportion of its workers than any other American industry. Consequently, a low minimum wage has long been a crucial part of the fast food industry's business plan. Between 1968 and 1990, the years when the fast food chains expanded at their fastest rate, the real value of the U.S. minimum wage fell by almost 40%. In the late 1990s, the real value of the U.S. minimum wage still remained about 27% lower than it was in the late 1960s. Nevertheless, the National Restaurant Association, NRA, has vehemently opposed any rise in the minimum wage at the federal, state, or local level. While the real value of the wages paid to restaurant workers has declined for the past 3 decades, the earnings of restaurant company executives have risen considerably. According to a 1997 survey in Nation's Restaurant News, the average corporate executive bonus was $131,000, an increase of 20% over the previous year. Increasing the federal minimum wage by a dollar would add about 2 cents to the cost of a fast food hamburger. In 1938, at the height of the Great Depression, Congress passed legislation to prevent employers from exploiting the nation's most vulnerable workers. The Fair Labor Standards Act established the first federal minimum wage. It also imposed limitations on child labor, and it mandated that employees who work more than 40 hours a week be paid overtime wages for each additional hour. The overtime wage was set at a minimum of 1.5 times the regular wage. Today, few employees in the fast food industry qualify for overtime, and even fewer are paid it. Roughly 90% of the nation's fast food workers are paid an hourly wage, provided no benefits, and scheduled to work only as needed. Crew members are employed at will. If the restaurant's busy, they're kept longer than usual. If business is slow, they're sent home early. Managers try to make sure that each worker is employed less than 40 hours a week, thereby avoiding any overtime payments. A typical McDonald's or Burger King restaurant has about 50 crew members. They work an average of 30 hours a week. By hiring a large number of crew members for each restaurant, sending them home as soon as possible, and employing them for fewer than 40 hours a week whenever possible, the chains keep their labor costs to a bare minimum. After working at Burger King restaurants for about a year, the sociologist Esther Rosterreiter concluded that the trait most valued in fast food workers is obedience. In other mass production industries ruled by the assembly line, labor unions have gained workers higher wages, formal grievance procedures, and a voice in how the work is performed. The high turnover rates at fast food restaurants, the part-time nature of the jobs, and the marginal social status of the crew members have made it difficult to organize their workers, and the fast food chains have fought against unions with the same zeal they've displayed fighting hikes in the minimum wage. The McDonald's Corporation insists that its franchise operators follow directives on food preparation, purchasing, store design, and countless other minute details. Company specifications cover everything from the size of the pickle slices to the circumference of the paper cups. When it comes to wage rates, however, the company is remarkably silent and laissez-faire. This policy allows operators to set their wages according to local labor markets, and it absolves the McDonald's Corporation of any formal responsibility for roughly 3/4 of the company's workforce. McDonald's decentralized hiring practices have helped thwart efforts to organize the company's workers. But whenever a union gains support at a particular restaurant, the McDonald's Corporation suddenly shows tremendous interest in the emotional and financial well-being of the workers there. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, McDonald's workers across the country attempted to join unions. In response, the company developed sophisticated methods for keeping unions out of its restaurants. A flying squad of experienced managers and corporate executives was sent to a restaurant the moment union activity was suspected. Seemingly informal rap sessions were held with disgruntled employees. the workers were encouraged to share their feelings. They were flattered and stroked. And more importantly, they were encouraged to share information about the union's plans and the names of union sympathizers. If the rap sessions failed to provide adequate information, the stroking was abandoned for a more direct approach. In 1973, amid a bitter organizing drive in San Francisco, a group of young McDonald's employees claimed that managers had forced them to take lie detector tests, interrogated them about union activities, and threatened them with dismissal if they refused to answer. Spokesmen for McDonald's admitted that polygraph tests had been administered, but denied that any coercion was involved. Brian Seal, San Francisco's labor commissioner, closely studied some of McDonald's old job applications and found a revealing paragraph in small print near the bottom. It said that employees who wouldn't submit to lie detector tests could face dismissal. The labor commissioner ordered McDonald's to halt the practice, which was a violation of state law. He also ordered the company to stop accepting tips at its restaurants, since customers were being misled. The tips being left for crew members were actually being kept by the company. The San Francisco union drive failed, as did every other McDonald's union drive, with one exception. Workers at a McDonald's in Mason City, Iowa, voted to join the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in 1971. The union lasted just 4 years. The McDonald's Corporation no longer asks crew members to take lie detector tests and advises its franchisees to obey local labor laws. Nevertheless, top McDonald's executives still travel from Oak Brook, Illinois, to the site of a suspected union drive, even when the restaurant is overseas. Rap sessions and high-priced attorneys have proved to be effective tools for ending labor disputes. The company's guidance has helped McDonald's franchisees defeat literally hundreds of efforts to unionize. Almost every fast food restaurant in Colorado Springs has a banner or sign that says, "Now hiring." The fast food chains have become victims of their own success as one business after another tries to poach their teenage workers. Teenagers now sit behind the front desk at hotels, make calls for telemarketers, sell running shoes at the mall. The low unemployment rate in Colorado Springs has made the task of finding inexpensive workers even more difficult. Meanwhile, the competition among fast food restaurants has increased. Chains that have competed in the city for years keep opening new outlets, while others are entering the market for the first time. Carl's Jr. has come to Colorado Springs, opening standalone restaurants and co-branded outlets inside Texaco gas stations. When a fast food restaurant goes out of business, a new one often opens at the same location, like an army that sees the outpost of a conquered foe. Instead of a new flag being raised, a big new plastic sign goes up. Local fast food franchisees have little ability to reduce their fixed costs, their lease payments, franchise fees, and purchases from company-approved suppliers. Franchisees do, however, have some control over wage rates and try to keep them as low as possible. The labor structure of the fast food industry demands a steady supply of young and unskilled workers, but the immediate needs of the chains and the long-term needs of teenagers are fundamentally at odds. At Cheyenne Mountain High School, set in the foothills with a grand view of the city, few of the students work at fast food restaurants. Most of them are white and upper middle class. During the summers, the boys often work as golf caddies or swimming pool lifeguards. The girls often work as babysitters at the Broadmoor. When Cheyenne Mountain kids work during the school year, they tend to find jobs at the mall, the girls employed at clothing stores like The Gap or The Limited, the boys at sporting goods stores like The Athlete's Foot. These jobs provide discounts on merchandise and a chance to visit with school friends who are out shopping. The pay of a job is often less important than its social status. Working as a hostess at an upscale chain restaurant like Kariba's, TGI Fridays, or the Outback Steakhouse is considered a desirable job, even if it pays minimum wage. Working at a fast food restaurant is considered bottom of the heap. Jane Trogdon is the head of the guidance department at Harrison High School in Colorado Springs. Harrison has the reputation of being a rough school, a gang school. The rap is not entirely deserved. It may have stuck because Harrison is where many of the city's poorest teenagers go to school. Harrison is where you will find an abundance of fast food workers. About 60% of the students come from low-income families. In a town with a relatively low minority population, only 40% of the students at Harrison are white. The school occupies a clean, modern building on the south side of town, right next to I-25. From some of the classroom windows, you can see the cars zooming past. On the other side of the interstate, a new multiplex theater with 24 screens beckons students to cut class. Teachers often don't want to teach at Harrison, and some don't last there for long. Jane Trogdon has worked at the school since the day it opened in 1967. Over the past three decades, Trogdon has observed tremendous changes in the student body. Harrison was always the school on the wrong side of the tracks, but the kids today seem poorer than ever. It used to be, even in many low-income families, that the father worked and the mother stayed home to raise the children. Now, it seems that no one's home and that both parents work just to make ends meet, often holding down two or three jobs. Many of the kids at Harrison are on their own from an early age. Parents increasingly turn to the school for help, asking teachers to supply discipline and direction. The teachers do their best, despite a lot of disrespect from students and the occasional threat of violence. Trogdon worries about the number of kids at Harrison who leave school in the afternoon and go straight to work, mainly at fast food restaurants. She also worries about the number of hours they're working. Although some students at Harrison work at fast food restaurants to help their families, most of the kids take jobs after school in order to have a car. In the suburban sprawl of Colorado Springs, having your own car seems like a necessity. Car payments and insurance easily come to $300 a month. As more and more kids work to get their own wheels, fewer participate in after-school sports and activities. They stay at their jobs late into the night, neglect their homework, and come to school exhausted. In Colorado, kids can drop out of school at the age of 16. Dropping out often seems tempting to sophomores who are working in the real world, earning money, being eagerly recruited by local fast food chains, retail chains, and telemarketers. 30 years ago, businesses didn't pursue teenage workers so aggressively. Harrison usually has about 400 students in its freshman class. About half of them eventually graduate. Perhaps 50 go to college. When Trogdon first came to work at Harrison, the Vietnam War was at its peak, and angry battles raged between long-haired students and kids whose fathers were in the military. Today, she senses a profound apathy at the school. The turmoil of an earlier era has been replaced by a sad and rootless anemone. "I have lots and lots of kids who are terribly depressed," Trogdon says. "I've never seen so many, so young, feel this way." Trogdon's insights about teenagers and after-school jobs are supported by Protecting Youth at Work, a report on child labor published by the National Academy of Sciences in 1998. It concluded that the long hours many American teenagers now spend on the job pose a great risk to their future educational and financial success. Numerous studies have found that kids who work up to 20 hours a week during the school year generally benefit from the experience, gaining an increased sense of personal responsibility and self-esteem. But kids who work more than that are far more likely to cut classes and drop out of high school. Teenage boys who work longer hours are much more likely to develop substance abuse problems and commit petty crimes. The negative effects of working too many hours are easy to explain. When kids go to work, they are neither at home nor at school. If the job is boring, overly regimented, or meaningless, it can create a lifelong aversion to work. All of these trends are most pronounced among poor and disadvantaged teenagers. While stressing the great benefits of work in moderation, the National Academy of Sciences report warned that short-term considerations are now limiting what millions of American kids can ever hope to achieve. Eliza Zamat is a junior at Harrison High. In addition to working at McDonald's on the weekends, she also works there 2 days a week after school. Altogether, she spends about 30 to 35 hours a week at the restaurant. She earns the minimum wage. Her parents, Carlos and Cynthia, are loving but strict. They're Puerto Rican and moved to Colorado Springs from Lakewood, New Jersey. They make sure Eliza does all her homework and impose a midnight curfew. Eliza's usually too tired to stay out late anyway. Her school bus arrives at 6 in the morning and classes start at 7. Eliza had wanted to work at McDonald's ever since she was a toddler, a feeling shared by many of the McDonald's workers I met in Colorado Springs. But now, she hates the job and is desperate to quit. Working at the counter, she constantly has to deal with rude remarks and complaints. Many of the customers look down on fast food workers and feel entitled to treat them with disrespect. Sweet-faced Eliza is often yelled at by strangers angry that their food's taking too long or that something is wrong with their order. One elderly woman threw a hamburger at her because there was mustard on it. Eliza hopes to find her next job at a Walmart, at a clothing store, anywhere but a fast food restaurant. None of the fast food workers I met in Colorado Springs spoke of organizing a union. The thought has probably to them. When these kids don't like the working conditions or the manager, they quit. Then they find a job at another restaurant, and the cycle goes on and on. The injury rate of teenage workers in the United States is about twice as high as that of adult workers. Teenagers are far more likely to be untrained, and every year, about 200,000 are injured on the job. The most common workplace injuries at fast food restaurants are slips, falls, strains, and burns. The fast food industry's expansion, however, coincided with a rising incidence of workplace violence in the United States. Roughly 4 or 5 fast food workers are now murdered on the job every month, usually during the course of a robbery. Although most fast food robberies end without bloodshed, the level of violent crime in the industry is surprisingly high. In 1998, more restaurant workers were murdered on the job in the United States than police officers. America's fast food restaurants are now more attractive to armed robbers than convenience stores, gas stations, or banks. Other retail businesses increasingly rely upon credit card transactions. But fast food restaurants still do almost all of their business in cash. While convenience store chains have worked hard to reduce the amount of money in the till, at 7-Eleven stores, the average robbery results in a loss of about $37, fast food restaurants often have thousands of dollars on the premises. Gas stations and banks now routinely shield employees behind bullet-resistant barriers, a security measure that would be impractical at most fast food restaurants. And the same features that make these restaurants so convenient, their location near intersections and highway off-ramps, even their drive-through windows, facilitate a speedy getaway. A fast food robbery is most likely to occur when only a few crew members are present, early in the morning before customers arrive, or late at night near closing time. A couple of 16-year-old crew members and a 20-year-old assistant manager are often the only people locking up a restaurant long after midnight. When a robbery takes place, the crew members are frequently herded into the basement freezer. The robbers empty the cash registers and the safe, then hit the road. The same demographic groups widely employed at fast food restaurants, the young and the poor, are also responsible for much of the nation's violent crime. According to industry studies, about 2/3 of the robberies at fast food restaurants involve current or former employees. The combination of low pay, high turnover, and ample cash in the restaurant often leads to crime. A 1999 survey by the National Food Service Security Council, a group funded by the large chains, found that about half of all restaurant workers engaged in some form of cash or property theft, not including the theft of food. The typical employee stole about $218 a year. New employees stole almost $100 more. Studies conducted by Gerald Greenberg, a professor of management at the University of Ohio and an expert on workplace crime, have found that when people are treated with dignity and respect, they're less likely to steal from their employer. It may be common sense, Greenberg says, but it's obviously not common practice. The same anger that causes most petty theft, the same desire to strike back at an employer perceived as unfair, can escalate to armed robbery. Restaurant managers are usually, but not always, the victims of fast food crimes. Not long ago, the day manager of a McDonald's in Moore Park, California, recognized the masked gunman emptying the safe. It was the night manager. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, attempted in the mid-1990s to issue guidelines for preventing violence at restaurants and stores that do business at night. OSHA was prompted, among other things, by the fact that homicide had become the leading cause of workplace fatalities among women. The proposed guidelines were entirely voluntary and seemed innocuous. OSHA recommended, for example, that late-night retailers improve visibility within their stores and make sure their parking lots were well lit. The National Restaurant Association, along with other industry groups, responded by enlisting more than 100 congressmen to oppose any OSHA guidelines on retail violence. An investigation by the Los Angeles Times found that many of these congressmen had recently accepted donations from the NRA and the National Association of Convenience Stores. Who would oppose putting out guidelines on saving women's lives in the workplace? Joseph Deere, a former head of OSHA, said to a Times reporter, "The companies that employ those women." The leading fast food chains have tried to reduce violent crime by spending millions on new security measures, video cameras, panic buttons, drop safes, burglar alarms, additional lighting. But even the most heavily guarded fast food restaurants remain vulnerable. In April of 2000, a Burger King on the grounds of Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska was robbed by two men in ski masks carrying shotguns. They were wearing purple Burger King shirts and got away with more than $7,000. Joseph A. Kinney, the president of the National Safe Workplace Institute, argues that the fast food industry needs to make fundamental changes in its labor relations. Raising wages and making a real commitment to workers will do more to cut crime than investing in hidden cameras. No other American industry, Kinney notes, is robbed so frequently by its own employees. Few of the young fast food workers I met in Colorado Springs were aware that working early in the morning or late at night placed them in some danger. Jose, on the other hand, had no illusions. He was a 19-year-old assistant manager with a sly, mischievous look. Before going to work at McDonald's, Jose had been a drug courier and a drug dealer in another state. He'd witnessed the murder of close friends. Many of his relatives were in prison for drug-related and violent crimes. Jose had left all that behind. His job at McDonald's was part of a new life, and he liked being an assistant manager because the work didn't seem hard. He was not, however, going to rely on McDonald's for his personal safety. He said that video cameras weren't installed at his restaurant until the teeny Beanie Babies arrived. "Man, people really want to rip those things off," he said. "You've got to keep your eye on them." Jose often counts the money and closes the restaurant late at night. He always brings an illegal handgun to work, and a couple of his employees carry handguns, too. He's not afraid of what might happen if an armed robber walks in the door at night. "Ain't nothing that he could do to me," Jose said matter-of-factly, "that I couldn't do to him." The May 2000 murder of five Wendy's employees during a robbery in Queens, New York, received a great deal of media attention. The killings were gruesome. One of the murderers had previously worked at the restaurant, and the case unfolded in the media capital of the nation. But crime and fast food have become so ubiquitous in American society that their frequent combination usually goes unnoticed. Just a few weeks before the Wendy's massacre in Queens, two former Wendy's employees in South Bend, Indiana, received prison terms for murdering a pair of co-workers during a robbery that netted $1,400. Earlier in the year, two former Wendy's employees in Anchorage, Alaska, were charged with the murder of their night manager during a robbery. Hundreds of fast food restaurants are robbed every week. The FBI does not compile nationwide statistics on restaurant robberies, and the restaurant industry will not disclose them. Local newspaper accounts, however, give a sense of these crimes. In recent years, armed robberies struck 19 McDonald's and Burger King restaurants along Interstate 85 in Virginia and North Carolina. A former cook at a Shoney's in Nashville, Tennessee, became a fast food serial killer, murdering two workers at a Captain D's, three workers at a McDonald's, and a pair of Baskin-Robbins workers whose bodies were later found in a state park. A dean at Texas Southern University was shot and killed during a carjacking in the drive-through lane of a KFC in Houston. The manager of a Walmart McDonald's in Durham, North Carolina, was shot during a robbery by two masked assailants. A 9-year-old girl was killed during a shootout between a robber and an off-duty police officer waiting in line at a McDonald's in Barstow, California. A 20-year-old manager was killed during an armed robbery at a Sacramento, California McDonald's. The manager had recognized one of the armed robbers, a former McDonald's employee. It was the manager's first day in the job. A former employee at a McDonald's in Vallejo, California, shot three women who worked at the restaurant after being rejected for a new job. One of the women was killed, and the murderer left the restaurant laughing. And in Colorado Springs, a jury convicted a former employee of first-degree murder for the execution-style slayings of three teenage workers and a female manager at a Chuck E. Cheese's restaurant. The killings took place in Aurora, Colorado, at closing time, and police later arrived to find a macabre scene. The bodies lay in an empty restaurant as burglar alarms rang, game lights flashed, a vacuum cleaner ran, and Chuck E. Cheese's mechanical animals continued to perform children's songs. At the 38th Annual Multi-Unit Food Service Operators Conference, held a few years ago in Los Angeles, the theme was People, the Single Point of Difference. Most of the 1,400 attendees were chain restaurant operators and executives. The ballroom at the Century Plaza Hotel was filled with men and women in expensive suits, a well-to-do group whose members looked as though they hadn't grilled a burger or mopped a floor in a while. The leading topic of conversation at the scheduled workshops, in the hallways and hotel bars, was how to find inexpensive workers in an American economy where unemployment had fallen to a 24-year low. James C. Daugherty, the publisher of Nation's Restaurant News at the time, gave a speech urging the restaurant industry to move away from relying on a low-wage workforce with high levels of turnover, and to promote instead the kind of labor policies that would create long-term careers in food service. How can workers look to this industry for a career, he asked, when it pays them the minimum wage and provides them no health benefits? Daugherty's suggestions received polite applause. The keynote speech was given by David Novak, the president of Tricon Global Restaurants. His company operates more restaurants than any other company in the world, 30,000 Pizza Huts, Taco Bells, and KFCs. A former advertising executive with a boyish face and the earnest delivery style of a motivational speaker, Novak charmed the crowd. He talked about the sort of recognition his company tried to give its employees, the pep talks, the prizes, the special awards of plastic chili peppers and rubber chickens. He believed the best way to motivate people is to have fun. Cynics need to be in some other industry, he said. Employee awards created a sense of pride and esteem. They showed that management was watching, and they did not cost a lot of money. We want to be a great company for the people who make it great, Novak announced. Other speakers talked about teamwork, empowering workers, and making it fun. During the president's panel, the real sentiments of the assembled restaurant operators and executives became clear. Norman Brinker, a legend in the industry, the founder of Bennigan's and Steak and Ale, the current owner of Chili's, a major donor to the Republican Party, spoke to the conference in language that was simple, direct, and free of platitudes. "I see the possibility of unions," he warned. The thought chilled him. He asked everyone in the audience to give more money to the industry's key lobbying groups. And Senator Kennedy's pushing hard on a $7.25 minimum wage, he continued. That'll be fun, won't it? I love the idea of that. I sure do. Strike me dead. As the crowd laughed and roared and applauded Brinker's call to arms against unions and the government, the talk about teamwork fell into the proper perspective. Success. Matthew Cabang glides his 83 Buick LeSabre through the streets of Pueblo, Colorado, at night, looking for a trailer park called Meadowbrook. Two Little Caesars pizzas and a bag of crazy bread sit in the back seat. "Welcome to my office," he says, reaching down, turning up the radio, playing some mellow rhythm and blues. Cabang was born in Nigeria and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. He studies electrical engineering at a local college, hopes to own a radio shack someday, and delivers pizzas for Little Caesars 4 or 5 nights a week. He earns the minimum wage, plus $1 for each delivery, plus tips. On a good night, he makes about $50. We cruise past block after block of humble little houses, whitewashed and stucco, built decades ago, with pickup trucks in the driveways and children's toys on the lawns. Pueblo is the southernmost city along the Front Range, 40 miles from Colorado Springs, but for generations, a world apart, largely working class and Latino. A town with steel mills that was never hip like Boulder, bustling like Denver, or aristocratic like Colorado Springs. Nobody ever built a polo field in Pueblo, and snobs up north still call it the asshole of Colorado. We turn a corner and find Meadowbrook. All the trailers look the same, slightly ragged around the edges, lined up in neat rows. Cabang parks the car, and when the radio and the headlights shut off, the street suddenly feels empty and dark. Then somewhere a dog barks, the door of a nearby trailer opens, and light spills onto the gravel driveway. A little white girl with blonde hair, about 7 years old, smiles at this big Nigerian bringing pizza, hands him $15, takes the food, and tells him to keep the change. Behind her, there's movement in the trailer, a brief glimpse of someone else's life, a tidy kitchen, the flickering shadows of a TV. The door closes and Cabang heads back to the Buick, his office, beneath a huge sky full of stars. He has a $1.76 tip in his pocket, the biggest tip so far tonight. The wide gulf between Colorado Springs and Pueblo, a long-standing social, cultural, political, and economic division, is starting to narrow. As you drive through the streets of Pueblo, you can feel the change coming, something palpable in the air. During the 1980s, the city's unemployment rate hovered at about 12%, and not much was built. New things now seem to appear every month. New roads around the Pueblo Mall, new movie theaters, a new Applebee's, an Olive Garden, a Home Depot, a great big Marriott. Subdivisions are creeping south from Colorado Springs along I-25, turning cattle ranches into street after street of ranch-style homes. Pueblo has not boomed yet. It seems ready, right on the verge, about to become more like the rest. The Little Caesars where Cabang works is in the Belmont section of town, across the street from a Dunkin' Donuts, not far from the University of Southern Colorado campus. The small square building the Little Caesars occupies used to house a Godfather's Pizza, and before that, a dairy bar. The restaurant has half a dozen brown formica tables, red brick walls, a gumball machine near the counter, white and brown flecked linoleum floors. The place is clean, but has not been redecorated for a while. The customers who drop by or call for pizza are college students, ordinary working people, people with large families, and the poor. Little Caesar's pizzas are big and inexpensive, often providing enough food for more than one meal. 5 crew members work in the kitchen, putting toppings on pizzas, putting the pizzas in the oven, getting drinks, taking orders over the phone. Julio, a 19-year-old kid with 2 kids of his own, slides a pizza off the old Blodgett oven's conveyor belt. He makes $6.50 an hour. He enjoys making pizza. The ovens have been automated at Little Caesars and at the other pizza chains, but the pizzas are still handmade. They're not just pulled out of a freezer. Dave Feemster, the owner of the restaurant, is completely at ease behind the counter, hanging out with his Latino employees and customers, but at the same time, seems completely out of place. Feimster was born and raised in a working-class neighborhood of Detroit. He grew up playing in youth hockey leagues and later attended college in Colorado Springs on an athletic scholarship. He was an All-American during his senior year, a defenseman picked by the Chicago Blackhawks in the college draft. After graduating from Colorado College with a degree in business, Feimster played in the National Hockey League, a childhood dream come true. The Blackhawks reached the playoffs during his first 3 years on the team, and Feimster got to compete against some of his idols, against Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier. Feimster was not a big star, but he loved the game, earned a good income, and traveled all over the country. Not bad for a blue-collar kid from Detroit. On March 14, 1984, Feimster was struck from behind by Paul Holmgren during a game with the Minnesota North Stars. Feimster never saw the hit coming and slammed into the boards head first. He felt dazed, but played out the rest of the game. Later, in the shower, his back started to hurt. An X-ray revealed a stress fracture of a bone near the base of his spine. For the next 3 months, Feimster wore a brace that extended from his chest to his waist. The cracked bone didn't heal. At practice sessions the following autumn, he didn't feel right. The Blackhawks wanted him to play, but a physician at the Mayo Clinic examined him and said, "If you were my son, I'd say find another job, move on." Feimster worked out for hours at the gym every day, trying to strengthen his back. He lived with two other Blackhawk players. Every morning, the three of them would eat breakfast together. Then his friends would leave for practice, and Feimster would find himself just sitting there at the table. The Blackhawks never gave him a goodbye handshake or wished him good luck. He wasn't even invited to the team Christmas party. They paid off the remainder of his contract, and that was it. He floundered for a year, feeling lost. At a college reunion in Colorado Springs, an old friend suggested that Feimster become a Little Caesars franchisee. Feimster had played on youth hockey teams in Detroit with the sons of the company's founder, Mike Ilitch. He was too embarrassed to call the Ilitch family and ask for help. His friend dialed the phone. Within weeks, Feimster was washing dishes and making pizzas at Little Caesars restaurants in Chicago and Denver. It felt a long, long way from the NHL. Before gaining the chance to own a franchise, he had to spend months learning every aspect of the business. He was trained like any other assistant manager and earned $300 a week. At first, he wondered if this was a good idea. The Little Caesars franchise fee was $15,000, almost all the money he had left in the bank. Becoming a franchisee is an odd combination of starting your own business and going to work for someone else. At the heart of a franchise agreement is the desire by two parties to make money while avoiding risk. The franchisor wants to expand an existing company without spending its own funds. The franchisee wants to start his or her own business without going it alone and risking everything on a new idea. One provides a brand name, a business plan, expertise, access to equipment, and supplies. The other puts up the money and does the work. The relationship has built-in tensions. The franchisor gives up some control by not wholly owning each operation. The franchisee sacrifices a great deal of independence by having to obey the company's rules. Everyone's happy when the profits are rolling in, but when things go wrong, the arrangement often degenerates into a mismatched battle for power. The franchisor almost always wins. Franchising schemes have been around in one form or another since the 19th century. In 1898, General Motors lacked the capital to hire salesmen for its new automobiles, so it sold franchises to prospective car dealers, giving them exclusive rights to certain territories. Franchising was an ingenious way to grow a new company in a new industry. Instead of the company paying the salesman, Stan Luxenberg, a franchise historian, explained, the salesman would pay the company. The automobile, soft drink, oil, and motel industries later relied upon franchising for much of their initial growth. But it was the fast food industry that turned franchising into a business model soon emulated by retail chains throughout the United States.